Eve. So we're reading really the story of Joseph. So that's in Genesis chapter 39. We've looked at a couple of these. So it's 39 and verses, it's really the second half of verse 6 there. Here's Joseph. He's been sold by his brothers into slavery in Egypt. He's been purchased by Potiphar. First six verses are really about how the Lord is with him, and he has been faithfully serving the Lord in the job that he's been given to do as a slave, as ultimately the chief steward, as it were, in Potiphar's house. And we've just read of how Potiphar's entrusted everything to his care. And then in the second half of chapter of verse 6 there, we read this. This is page 44. Now, Joseph was well built and handsome. And after a while, his master's wife took notice of Joseph and said, "Come to bed with me." But he refused. "With me in charge," he told her, "my master doesn't concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" And though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. And one day he went into the house to attend to his duties, and none of the household servants was inside. And she caught him by his cloak and said, "Come to bed with me." But he left his cloak in her hand and ran out of the house. And when she saw that he had left his cloak in her hand and had run out of the house, she called her household servants. "Look," she said to them, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us. He came in here to sleep with me, but I screamed. And when he heard me scream for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house." She kept his cloak beside her until his master came home, and then she told him this story. "That Hebrew slave that you brought us came to me to make sport of me. But as soon as I screamed for help, he left his cloak beside me and ran out of the house. And when his master heard the story, his wife told him, saying, 'This is how your slave treated me,' he burned with anger. And Joseph's master took him and put him in prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined. But while Joseph was there in the prison, the Lord was with him. He showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warder. And so the warder put Joseph in charge of all those held in the prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there. And the warder paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in whatever he did." Amen. And may God bless to us the reading of his word. Now we'll sing again. Just a reminder before we look at Genesis 39, a reminder, something I mentioned this morning that Norman was picking up in prayer there, just that there is still the opportunity for anyone who's able to help with marshalling or anything else, actually, with this community funding next Saturday. So if you can help, by again, feel free to speak to myself or to Norman there. Now we're going to have a look at this. There's a lot in this chapter, so we're going to have a look at this chapter again towards the end of it next week as well. But particularly this temptation with Potiphar's wife in relation to Joseph. It's interesting, we were talking about anniversaries this morning, and I was mentioning that it's 60 years since Lord of the Flies was published. You may also have noticed this weekend that it's 70 years since Operation Market Garden, Second World War, when Allied troops were parachuted behind enemy lines into the Netherlands. It was an attempt to bring the Second World War in Europe to a speedy close, and it It proved, on reflection, a pretty disastrous operation. It resulted, of course, in the Battle of Arnhem, thousands of casualties, and after 9 days of fierce fighting with no support from ground troops, the airborne troops were eventually withdrawn. And, of course, you may be familiar with that story, told at least to some degree in the film A Bridge Too Far. But just take that picture for a moment. Being parachuted behind enemy lines. And having to fight there, survive there, as it were, on your own. That's a fairly scary prospect, isn't it? And yet there is a sense in which it serves, I think, as a picture of the Christian life. Christian finds themselves living and working in a real sense behind enemy lines, having to live their life in a world, in a society, in a community where, though God is still sovereign, absolutely sovereign, although Jesus Christ is Lord, absolutely Lord, the prevailing spirit in that world, in that society, in that community, is one of resistance and rebellion against God's rule and against the lordship of Christ. But not only that, and therefore because of that, the Christian finds himself struggling, as it were, fighting in one sense, but not only that, there is also an internal struggle and warfare that goes on simultaneously. There are rebel elements, aren't there, within the life, in the heart of every Christian believer. And therefore that battle, as it were, behind enemy lines, is fought on two fronts, that internal front and that external front. Listen again to the words of Peter that we quoted last week, 1 Peter 2:11. Beloved, I urge you as sojourners and exiles, there you are, behind enemy lines, as it were, I urge you as sojourners and exiles to abstain from the passions of the flesh which wage war against your soul. There's the internal battle, isn't it? Not against others, but with rebel passions, as it were, and desires that are operating, still operating within your own heart. You're behind enemy lines, but there's an enemy within as well. And that battle can therefore be painful and costly internally and also externally. It's a battle which can be painfully and costly, but it is a battle which the Christian must seek to win for God's sake, but also for the sake of others. Listen to how Peter goes on there. Keep your conduct among the Gentiles honorable, so that when they speak against you as evildoers, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day of visitation. Now, the question I want us to think about this evening, if you're a Christian, if you're a follower of Jesus, then how are you doing in that battle? How are you doing in that battle, internal particularly, as well as external? You're finding it hard going, I suspect. Have you given in, given up, compromised? Is there a sense in which as you go into the world, Norman was praying about apprehensions for the coming week, is there a sense in which you go into the world with a sense it's just not possible to live as a Christian in this context, whether it's a work context or a family context or a society context, with the things out there, but also the struggles that are going on here? Well, you see, again, here in Joseph, in Egypt, in Potiphar's house, is an example of a man of faith fighting that kind of battle, isn't there? Fighting, indeed, and winning that battle internally, and yet, as a result of that, also suffering for it externally. And therefore, I think there's a lot to learn here. See, if faithfulness, and maybe we could have, I don't think we used this title, but if faithfulness publicly displayed was a good title, or is a good title, for the opening six verses of chapter 39 of Genesis, then I think faithfulness, painfully tested and tried, would seem to be an appropriate title for the rest of the chapter. The fight of faith is fierce here, isn't it, for Joseph? Joseph is severely tested and tried in his faith and in his faithfulness. And again, that's likely to be the lot of every believer at some point living for Christ in exile. And that reality actually is brought home when you realize that in no sense here does Joseph go looking for this particular temptation and this particular test. It's not that he is walking on the edge here. It's not that he's taking moral risks. He's not looking for trouble. He's not looking for temptation. He's not inviting it by the company that he keeps or by the places that he goes. He is simply doing his job. He is simply where God at this point in his life wants him to be, doing what God at this particular time in his life wants him to do. And as we saw last week, he is doing it well. But temptation comes. He's not looking for it. He's not courting it. But it comes. And you can see some of the characteristics, don't you, of this particular test, this particular temptation for Joseph. First of all, it's persistent, isn't it? I'm not talking about a one-off here. It wasn't as if Potiphar's wife came to him one day and with a suggestion, lie with me, and Joseph says no, and that's it. No, says verse 10 there, she spoke to him day after day. This is a constant battle. This is a daily struggle. This is a war of attrition that is being waged against Joseph. She sought by sheer persistence to weaken his resolve in a way that you may remember Delilah, for example, in another example in the Old Testament, by constant nagging sought to weaken Samson's resolve and tell her the secret of his strength. And of course, in that case, she succeeded. And Samson gave in with disastrous consequences, but Joseph didn't. And though, says Moses here, and though she spoke to Joseph day after day, he refused to go to bed with her or even to be with her. And again, when you think about that, it would be completely naive of us, wouldn't it? It would be completely naive of us to believe that there was nothing within Joseph that did not find the advances of Potiphar's wife appealing to some measure. And maybe more than just to some measure. I mean, you only, with a little imagination, I mean, this guy's, he's on his own. He's away from home. He's probably lonely. He's in a very vulnerable situation. It's not difficult to imagine here a real internal struggle, is it? Passions raging, as it were, within him. And combined with that inward appeal, you just think for a minute of the outward pressure as well. There is evidence, some evidence from the annals of history to suggest that actually the behavior of Potiphar's wife here was not exceptional or unusual in the Egypt of her day. That faithfulness to your husband was not something that was practiced generally. The extramarital affairs, as we would call them, were commonplace, and therefore there was that pressure also upon Joseph that I guess so many people today experience in relation to becoming involved in sexual activity, whether it's outside of marriage or before marriage. That, just that pressure, isn't it? Well, I mean, everybody else is doing it, so why not you? There are many reasons for Joseph to give in here. And on top of these, this may be speculation, but it's possible that Potiphar and his wife had a poor marriage. Certainly Potiphar never seems to be around, preoccupied with his wife, perhaps, with his work rather, neglecting his wife. She certainly seems to display a certain contempt for him in her falsified account of what happened in verse 17 there. Did you notice that when she says, "That Hebrew slave you brought us came to me to make sport of me." Hear that phrase, "you brought us"? That's echoes, isn't it, of the Garden of Eden. You know, "the woman you gave to me, you brought to us." And similarly, the same too, in verse 14, this Hebrew, when she's telling the slaves, the servant, "this Hebrew has been brought to us to make sport of us." And of course, brought to us by whom? Well, Potiphar, of course. Again, you just sense there an air of contempt or lack of respect for her husband. And maybe there were grounds for that. Maybe there was a constant tension between these two. Maybe the marriage was as good as dead. Maybe Joseph could have felt sorry for her. Maybe Joseph could have excused his compliance with her desires on the basis that the marriage was beyond repair. Now, of course, all of that is pretty speculative. I have to concede that. But one thing is true, that whenever you and I are tempted to go down a path that would go against God's way, that would break faith with God and with others, we will never be short of reasons for justifying going down that path. We'll never be short of seemingly good grounds, plausible excuses to justify our actions. Will always be at hand. There is an enemy who will always make that the case. Have you ever noticed that in a moment of temptation? Never are short of reasons, excuses to do the wrong thing. And they were there for Joseph, I suspect. And yet he resisted. And the question is why or how? How was he able to control these passions, as Peter calls them? These inward desires. How was he able to resist that outward pressure, to stand up to the persistence of these advances? And at last, when in effect he was ambushed, still get out and say no. Well, I think first and foremost, we have to say, because God was with him. We have to say the grace of God enabled him to stand, saving grace, sustaining grace. Sure, surely Joseph himself would have said that. We must say that. That great line in Titus, Paul writing to Titus, when he, Titus 2 and 11, "For the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men. It teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age." That's what grace does, the grace revealed in Jesus Christ. It teaches us to say no. And of course, with that, it also enables us to say no. And that's true of every one of us. No person can be true to the will of God. No person can remain faithful to the will of God in time of testing, under temptation, without God's enabling grace and power. We would fall flat every time were it not for him. It is he, ultimately, who makes the difference. I remember a long time ago hearing a story about Augustine, the life of Augustine, who was a Christian from the 4th century. I guess many of you will have known him, heard of him, a huge influence upon the Christian church. But Augustine, if you know anything about him, before he became a Christian, he had, by his own admission, been controlled, really, and dominated by his sexual desires, among other things. And he'd had a number of lovers. And one day after he'd become a Christian, one of his former lovers came up to him and in her most seductive tone said to him, "Augustine, it's I." To which Augustine replied, "Yes, but it's no longer I, Augustine, but Christ." Echoing Paul's words in Galatians. It is Christ who makes the difference. Union with him. Drawing from him. But then recognizing then the reality of God's protecting and sustaining grace is the underlying basis of Joseph's resistance. I think you can also identify two key principles here that held him back, as it were, from the course of action that was being presented to him. And you know, that if you were here this morning, that tweet, that from Lawrence Kirk, that pre-election advice, follow your heart, not your head. Well, generally speaking, at the moment of temptation, that is not godly advice. Don't follow your heart. Often follow your head. In other words, think. And indeed, do your thinking beforehand, in preparation, as it were, for what may or may not come in terms of temptation. You suspect that Joseph here had actually done his thinking beforehand. Because the nature, the clarity of his response to Potiphar's wife in that moment of temptation suggests that he has done his thinking beforehand. Suggests to me, at least, and to other writers too, that in the words of Romans 12 and 2, his mind has been, is being transformed by, or rather he is being transformed by the renewing of his mind, so that he is no longer being conformed to the pattern of this world, but at the moment of temptation is then able to test and to approve what God's will is. He's done his thinking beforehand, because two things dominate his thinking in his response to Potiphar's wife. Two things which need to dominate our thinking. And the first is this: think others. Think others. See, I suppose the most natural question, the instinctive reaction of fallen human beings to any choice in the moral realm, the moral spiritual realm, is to think me. To ask, to be taken up with at that point of decision, at that point of testing, of temptation, to think, what's in this for me? And if Joseph had asked that question exclusively in relation to the offer of Potiphar's wife, what might he have come up with? A bit of excitement, comfort in a strange land, physical pleasure, the satisfaction of a very natural and indeed God-given sexual desire. These things must have presented themselves to his mind as this offer was made to him again and again, day after day. But he never allowed them to drown out the first question that, as far as he was concerned, had to override it. Not what's in this for me, but what's in this if I go down this line for Potiphar? Never mind me for a minute. What's in it for him? Because doesn't that dominate his thinking here in verse 8? With me in charge, she says to Potiphar's wife, with me in charge, my master doesn't concern himself with anything in the house. Everything he owns, he has entrusted to my care. No one is greater in this house than I am. My master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. He's thinking Potiphar. I can't betray that trust. He would teach us, wouldn't he? Think others. Think others and the impact on others. And not me. But of course, equally and really over above that, and secondly, he would tell us, think God. Think God. I mean, Joseph is conscious of his responsibility to Potiphar, but even more of his responsibility to God. How then? I mean, having spoken so much about his relationship to Potiphar, you're not really expecting him to say what he says, but he does say it. How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? As if to say, in a sense, even if I could justify this in my own eyes, even if I could justify it in regard to Potiphar, even if I could argue that no one will be hurt by this, it's wrong in the sight of God. I can't do it. It has to be no. It's his God consciousness, isn't it? It's his God centeredness that keeps him from succumbing at this point to temptation. He never lost sight of what has always to be the primary issue in the decisions of life. How does God see this? What does his word have to say about this? Yeah, of course I can see what's on offer here. Yes, of course I'm aware of the desires within to which this offer appeals. And yes, I know what the world would tell me. And yes, I can justify going down this path in any number of ways, but first and foremost, what does God think? What does he have to say? You know that line in Psalm 119, how can a young man keep his way pure? By living according to your word. By thinking God. It's worth noting, I think, too, that it's that same God consciousness which you see in Joseph here. How can I do this wicked thing and sin against God? It's that same God consciousness that you see in Joseph here and which prevented him from succumbing to temptation, which we also find in David. On the other side, though, having given in to temptation, isn't it? Remember that after he'd been guilty with Bathsheba? Not only adultery with Bathsheba, but then even worse, murder in relation to Uriah. And you remember what he says in Psalm 51? Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. Isn't that an amazing statement, really? I mean, if you think about that story, David had sinned against everybody in that story, actually. He'd sinned against everybody, Bathsheba, Uriah, his own men. And yet he realized something that we need to remember, which obviously Joseph remembered. In all our sin, the most offended party and person is always God. You know, when we lose our temper with our wife or our husband or our children, the most offended person is God. When we cheat on our income tax, the most offended person is God. When we have an affair, when we hurt someone, the most offended person is God. That's not to say, of course, that others are not hurt or offended. Of course they are. But sin and wrongdoing is always, ultimately, first of all, against God. David was right. Against you, you only have I sinned and done what is evil in your sight. And remember also in that regard, specifically in regard to David there, it was actually that God consciousness, that admission of his sin being ultimately against God, which not only convicted him of his sin, but which also equally delivered him from ultimate despair once that sin had been revealed to him. Because, of course, what God revealed to him, what the Bible proclaims, what the cross of Jesus supremely proclaims, is what you and I always need to know when we have actually succumbed to temptation, when we have, like David, given in and fallen and failed. What we need to know at that point about God is that with God, there is forgiveness. On the basis of Jesus Christ, what we need to know, always need to know, that our failures need not be final or fatal because of what Christ has done for us. God consciousness, thinking God is crucial in this. Before temptation, but also, of course, when you have actually succumbed to temptation. But think about those two things in relation to fighting temptation. Think others, think God. Joseph does both here and remains faithful. Now, of course, it would be wonderful, wouldn't it? It would be wonderful if I could say to you, as a result of all this, of Joseph's loyalty to Potiphar, his faithfulness to God, that Mrs. Potiphar saw the error of her ways, was reconciled to her husband, and they both became believers in Joseph's God. But that's not what happens. Joseph incurs the full fury, doesn't he, of a woman's scorn. It's amazing how quickly, isn't it, that what the world would call love turns to hate. And he is accused, and he's summarily accused, he's convicted, as it were, summarily convicted of being a rapist, in effect. And is imprisoned, and you cannot help but notice that here's Joseph, and he's worse off, rather than better off, because of his faithfulness. Certainly in worldly terms. And he just illustrates, doesn't he, that faithfulness to God, faithfulness to Christ, life in exile, faithfulness in that context can have a cost. It can have a real cost. Paul didn't want Timothy or anyone else to be deceived about that when he wrote to him in 2 Timothy 3:12. In fact, everyone who wants to live a godly life will be persecuted, while evil men and imposters will go from bad to worse, deceiving and being deceived. And that is what happens here, isn't it? Joseph is persecuted. While Potiphar's wife actually gets worse, compounding her sin by her deception. There can be a cost to faithfulness. People lose money, people lose reputations, people lose freedoms, people lose their lives because they are faithful to God, to Christ. But then look at what Joseph has not lost. Verse 21. While Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him. He's not lost the presence of the Lord. And as we'll see, he's not lost the blessing of the Lord. Can't have relished prison. I don't want to sentimentalize prison here at all. In fact, if you know Psalm 105:18, it speaks of his feet being bruised with shackles, his neck being put in irons. But the Lord was there. You know, to go back to Operation Market Garden, one of the reasons it was a failure was because there was no ground support for the airborne troops. They were isolated. That never happens with God and his people. That never happens with God and his people. You remember Paul, again, to 2 Timothy, at my first defense, he says to Timothy, no one came to my support. Everyone deserted me. May it not be held against them. But then he says, but the Lord stood by me and gave me strength. The Lord's presence preserving and in some sense compensating even. I always remember, I think I've mentioned this before, but I mention it again. I always remember a letter from a Russian prison cell during the days of communist domination, written by the father of Georgi Vins, a Baptist, to his family. And this man wrote this. He says, it's doubtful that we shall be released though our only crime is faithfulness to the Lord. And then he wrote this, but he said, it's better to be with him in prison than at liberty without him. I don't want to lose the Lord's presence. Or I remember also once hearing a radio program which looked back over the life of Princess Margaret, Queen's sister. And one of the things it focused on was her relationship with Group Captain Peter Townsend. Some of you may remember all that. You know, the man that she wanted to marry, but because he was divorced, she couldn't do it without losing her title, without losing her royal income. And the program played a recording of his thoughts on the affair. And he said this, he said, I didn't feel I had sufficient weight to compensate for the losses that she would incur if she married me. couldn't give her sufficient to compensate for the losses. But you see, Georgi Binz's father obviously believed that God did have sufficient weight, that God did have sufficient worth to compensate for the losses incurred by being faithful to him. And Paul believed that too, didn't he? When he said, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of Christ Jesus, my Lord, for whose sake I've lost all things. Consider them rubbish, that I may gain Christ. He believed actually God could compensate. See, who knows the cost of resisting temptation and remaining faithful? Loss of promotion at work, loss of revenue, loss of your business, loss of the friendship of others perhaps. Who knows the cost of that? And of course, the answer to that is the Lord Jesus knows the cost of that. He, of all men and women, knows what it is to be parachuted behind enemy lines. He, of all men and women, knows what it is to be tempted and tried beyond anything any of us have ever known. He knows what it is to be totally alone in exile, to be abandoned by man and God on the cross. And yet, for the joy set before him, he endured the cross, despising its shame, sitting down at the right hand of God. He knows how to sustain the faithful in that cost. He knows how to compensate eternally the faithful for such cost. And so he says to us, as we'll sing in a moment, learn to scorn the praise of men. Learn to lose with God. For Jesus won the world through shame and beckons you his road. For right is right, since God is God, and right the day must win. To doubt would be disloyalty. To falter would be sin. Look at Joseph, but of course supremely, look at Jesus. Well, let's sing, shall we, those words that I was quoting there, workman of God.